Thank you. Good morning, everyone. It's very good to be with you. Heard many wonderful things about this church. My colleagues, I know Dr. Wu was just here with you, my good friends from the seminary. I have to say also, you guys are really organized. This has been on the books for a couple of years, I think. I think about the things that have happened in my life. I've had a kid, moved to a new house, lots of things in the middle of the time, you know, since I've had this planned. But I'm very, very glad to be with you. Excited to learn more about the Gospel of Matthew with you this month. Let's say a prayer together to get us started. This is actually from a PCUSA prayer app that I found that is probably the best thing about my iPhone, to be honest. The most life-giving thing about my phone. But this is a remarkable set of prayers. I love this one. The Thanksgiving Intercession Prayer for today, which Christians will be saying all over the world. So join me in prayer. Satisfy us with your love in the morning, and we will live this day in joy and praise, O Lord. From Psalm 90. Mighty God of mercy, we thank you for the resurrection dawn, bringing the glory of our risen Lord who makes every day new. We especially thank you this morning for the beauty of creation, for the new creation in Christ and all gifts of healing and forgiveness, for the sustaining love of family and friends, for the fellowship of faith in our church. Merciful God of might, renew this weary world, heal the hurts of your children, bring about your peace for all in Jesus Christ. We especially pray for those who govern nations of the world, people in countries ravaged by strife or warfare, all who work for peace and harmony, all who strive to save the earth from destruction, the Church of Jesus Christ in every land. In Christ's name we ask these things. Amen. All right. So, really briefly, because I've never been here, Sarah asked if I'd just share a little bit about myself, just so you kind of know who I am. I'm exposing myself here to criticism, too, because I'm going to talk about stories and how one tells their story. So I haven't thought through this much. You're going to learn more about me than I'd probably like. But I grew up in western Montana, and in terms of a very wonderful Christian home, kind of bounced around denominationally and ended up landing in the Presbyterian Church, which I'm very grateful for. So I'm not a Pittsburgh native. I've been in Pittsburgh for about 10 years after kind of moving around the country, going to school. I spent some time in Durham and North Carolina, and then here in Pittsburgh. So my passion, my sense of calling is as a New Testament scholar, is to study the scriptures. And I've had this interest since I was young. I loved Bible studies when I was growing up. I was always just really curious about scripture. And I have found that the more I study the Bible, the more curious I become about it. And so I feel it's one of the great things about this, doing this for a living, is I feel like I do learn new things, but my curiosity is only intensified the more I study. So this is an opportunity, honestly, for me to kind of share that with you through Matthew. This is a text that I've spent a lot of time with, and I feel like I still know very little about. And every time I read it, it continues to surprise me. That's probably my hope for us in this class, too, is that we would leave with, a holy curiosity or a desire to learn more, to read more. I think that's a much better gift. I think about this with my seminary students as well. I think some seminarians think that they take Bible classes to get the answers to the Bible. Or I teach Greek at the seminary. We learn Greek so we can get the answer key to the Bible. Far, far from it, right? I hope that I can give a much greater gift, which is that in close reading of the text, you discover that it's more mysterious and rich and deep than you thought before. And you leave with a changed disposition towards the text, right? Where you actually maybe discover a sense of emptiness in yourself. You realize you didn't know what you thought you knew before, and it's motivating you to continue reading more. Sarah had mentioned to me that interesting survey that was given to the church, and that the gospel passages didn't land in the top 10 of favorite passages in Scripture. What's that all about? I'm kidding. I actually have a theory of probably why that's the case. I don't think that's unusual at all. I think that's probably because for many of us who have been raised in the church, or who have spent a good deal of time in the church, we hear gospel stories a lot, don't we? Over and over and over again. And it's easy to think, because of the repetition, it's easy to think, you've got it. Right? Or I've heard that one before. Anybody ever said that? I've said that before. I've heard that one before, right? I hope we can discover together this Lent what the great hermeneutical philosopher Paul Ricoeur described as the second naivete. I love that term. So a first naivete would be you don't know anything about something new, you just dive in, it's all new, right? Second naivete is a naivete that comes after you've already been familiarized with something, and it becomes defamiliarized through a closer reading or through an encounter with another perspective or something, and you're able to revisit some place you've already been, but see it again like you've never been there before, right? It's a wonderful thing. For me, it's the greatest thing about being a New Testament professor is when I have seminary students that I can see they're in that second naivete moment. They're hearing these stories again like they've never heard them before. New and fresh and surprising ways. So here's where we're going for the next few weeks. The first session today, we're going to talk about kind of a bigger question about the Gospel of Matthew. And it's kind of a historical question, but it gets us into some of Matthew's themes and theology. It's the question of why did Matthew write a gospel at all? Okay. It'll give us a chance to kind of get a sense of the larger scope of Matthew's narrative. And then the rest of the time, we're going to kind of take deep dives into little portions throughout. Next week, we're going to talk about the infancy narrative in Matthew, so the birth story, up until the ministry of John the Baptist. Week three will be the initial test, as I'm calling it. So I think we'll talk about the ministry of John the Baptist, the baptism of Jesus, and then really kind of focus on the temptation of Christ before he begins his public ministry in Matthew. And then week four, Sarah has graciously offered to fill in for me in the 2 years since this has been planned. My father-in-law is getting married, and so I have to make a trip down to Tennessee for a wedding. So Sarah is going to lead us through a study of Bach's St. Matthew's Passion, which I really wish I could sit in on that. And then I will return for our final week where we're going to talk about the Gospel of the Kingdom, which is a summary of something Jesus says throughout in Matthew throughout his ministry to kind of summarize his teachings. So we're going to get into some of the distinctive teachings of Jesus in Matthew. Does that sound good? Okay, so here we go. Let's talk, number one, with week one. Why did Matthew write? This image here on the front, this is an ivory, I don't know what the official term would be, but it's from Italy, 10th century. It has the images of the four evangelists on it. I don't know if anybody are familiar with this, or actually I've never been to your church before, so I don't know if you have stained glass windows or images throughout the church where you might see some of these images replicated. It's very common to find in church architecture, but we see, so this is the image for the Gospel of Matthew, this is Mark, this is Luke, and this is John. Okay? And if you know where the symbolism here, so we have a man, they'll have wings, look, angels, right? A man, my battery is dead on this. The top right, Mark, is a lion. Bottom left, the ox is Luke, and John is the eagle. These animals come from the vision of the four beasts or creatures around the throne in the book of Revelation. And they have been understood by Christian theologians for centuries to kind of capture both the diversity of the evangelists, right? So they all look different, they all appear different. But in that Revelation throne room scene, what are they all doing? They're all around the throne and they're all singing the same song. Okay? So there's this idea of kind of unity in difference or something, or St. Augustine has this beautiful line, harmonious dissonance, okay, you find among the Gospels. So we're going to talk today about Matthew, top left. Matthew is, there's some of the, in reception, the different images are applied to different evangelists, but Matthew is consistently, or oftentimes, taken to be the man. Any ideas why that's the case? People would pick on key things and distinctive things in the Gospel. Any ideas? Anything strike you about the story? Yeah. There you go. So I mean, there is that aspect too, right? So we have traditionally the church has said that Matthew's gospel is written by an eyewitness, like the Gospel of John, right? The only two of the four evangelists who were actually followers of Christ. Oh, thank you so much. That will save me some time. Thank you. Right. So that is a possible thing that's going on there too. Any other ideas? Anyone? Well, one thing that you find sometimes is Matthew, we're going to talk about this a lot today, Matthew starts his gospel with a genealogy, right? So the face of the human face of the evangelist is taken to describe not just the evangelist, right, but the kind of distinctive portrait that the evangelist gives for Jesus, what kind of focus, in this case, it was sometimes said, we really see the human nature of Christ in the Gospel of Matthew by focusing on his genealogy. It'd be fun. We could go through and exegete all of these different things, but we're talking about the man today. Oops. All right. So this next image here I have is some famous, I could put millions of these up here, but a scene from a medieval cathedral. It has stained glass windows everywhere. Now, most people in the Middle Ages couldn't read. Okay, so having stained glass windows around in the church structure were ways of teaching people the stories of their faith. Right, they would hear these stories kind of preached and taught in different ways, but then they were literally kind of surrounded by these stories as they would worship. And I think there's a profound truth in that. Not just about Christianity, really, but all of kind of human experience. The reality that stories shape our sense of identity, right? Stories tell us, larger, bigger stories, narratives tell us who we are, right? They create meaning out of experience. Our stories can form us in positive and negative ways. I just told you a second ago, Sarah asked, who are you? It's impossible to answer that question and not do what? Tell a story, right? You have to tell a story to answer the question of who you are. And how you answer it, actually, can tell you sometimes about your assumptions of what you value, what's important, right? You talk about what you do. First and foremost, you talk about where you're from, right? Your skills, your triumphs, your failures. What you include in these stories and what you exclude is important. So it sounds as though my friend and colleague Ken Wu was just here talking about voices we often exclude in telling the story of the Reformation, right? So how is this relevant for Matthew? Well, early Christians in the first century were trying to figure out what their story was. Okay? This makes sense in this context. How do we fit in the Jewish world, in the Greco-Roman world? By the time Matthew's writing, lots of Christ followers are. We have a mixture of what? Folks who are ethnically Jewish and believe Jesus is the Messiah. Folks who are Gentiles who maybe were interested in Judaism before they heard about Jesus. And then you have folks that are just straight up Gentile pagans. They had no interest in Judaism before, no interest in monotheism before, okay? A very significant change for them. How do they fit? How do we all fit together? Who are we? Where are we going? I want to suggest that Matthew wrote his gospel in the first century to help Christians get their story straight. Okay, for this really diverse group of Christians with all these different experiences. He's not just sharing random tidbits or memories from the life of Jesus. It's not just a highlight reel from the life of Christ.
He's doing something much grander, more sophisticated, and more ambitious. Matthew's trying to explain what Jesus means in history. Right? And to do that, Matthew has to put Jesus, the story of Jesus, in the story of Israel, in the story of all of human history. Right? So the little things you see Jesus doing in the ministry, they reverberate in these kind of larger ways. Right? Because that's where that's for Matthew, the meaning is not just, it's not just about stories about a person who did things in Galilee in the 30s, the first century. Right? This is the climax of history, Matthew believes. So this story also, not just in terms of the significance of Jesus in the story of Israel, in the world history, but there's also implications of this story for the past, the present, and the future. Right? Even in my story, saying, who am I? How far back did I have to go to tell that story? Right? I started with kind of when I was born, right? But that assumes some interesting things, doesn't it? I didn't talk about my ancestors. If I started with my ancestors, how far back do I go with my ancestors, right? By not starting there, it assumes that what? For you to understand who I am, I don't consider that to be essential information, which tells you something about me, right? Maybe something about our culture. Okay, so Matthew wants people, when they finish reading the story, to see themselves in light of this story, to be transformed by the story, to maybe have a different sense of identity. And there are a number of reasons why this was a pressing issue in Matthew's time. I'm just going to name two things. So a very rough chronology here on the board, and I don't have time to discuss this much, even though this is very interesting, and I'd be happy to chat with any of you afterwards if you're curious about it. But I'm just going to assume for this presentation in this month that Matthew was written after the Gospel of Mark. Okay, this is basically the consensus of New Testament scholarship at this point. Even though Matthew is first in our canon, okay, the placement of Matthew first in the canon was not implied by those who put it in that way to say this is the first gospel written. It was placed there for theological or thematic reasons, which we'll see more, we'll understand more after today. Not for historical reasons. Mark is first. Matthew probably a decade or so later, okay? And you can see here, Mark sometime around, probably was written sometime around the destruction of the temple, and the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, a good 40 years after the life of Christ. Okay, so we're almost a good generation away now from the life of Jesus. And lots can happen in that time, right? New issues, new crises, new problems, right? Matthew's telling the story of Jesus, but it's the story of Jesus in light of what? New developments, right? Just like when we hear a sermon in a few minutes, right? We're hearing the story of Christ or something from Paul's epistles or something, right? But it's also told, the sermon is intentionally telling that story through what? Through and in light of and has been shaped by the experience in between, right? Who we are, where we are right now. It's the same thing for how Matthew wrote this gospel, okay? And given the fact Matthew wrote after Mark, you know, there are other ways of telling the story of Jesus operative in the time, right? And there's actually one really definitive one, which is the Gospel of Mark. The first, for some reason, Mark's the first one, we think, that actually decided to sit down and write something like a life or biography of Jesus. So someone's already done this, right? Someone's already tried to do this. Now, Mark's story has potential from Matthew's perspective, but it also leaves possible problems conceived in a certain way. Okay, I'm just going to name a couple of things. In terms of the contours or scope of the gospel. Okay, this is a really rough way of trying to just visualize for a second the size of these gospels. The Gospel of Mark is 16 chapters long. Matthew is 28 chapters long. Now again, those aren't going to be all identical in length, right? But it communicates a general point, which is what? Matthew is much, much bigger than Mark, right? And I also like, you see, at the how Matthew kind of extends beyond either end of Mark,
Because in terms of the contours or shape of Mark's gospel, think about where or how Mark begins the story of Jesus. If you read it carefully, there's no genealogy. There's no birth story. There's no Bethlehem. There's no Magi. There's no shepherds. The first scene in Mark is the ministry of John the Baptist in the wilderness. Jesus is already 30 years old. The first time we hear Jesus' name, Mark says rather blandly, and then Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee to be baptized by John. That's his entrance to the scene. Okay? Now, of course, Mark's readers probably knew a lot more about the prior stuff of Jesus, but Mark didn't, for whatever reason, include it. Okay? So it kind of raises questions, doesn't it? Who is this guy? Where did he come from? Why is he interested in this baptism of repentance for the forgiveness of sins, as John talks about? So there's questions about the beginning of Mark, and then think about the end. If you've ever looked at really any kind of modern English translation of the Gospel of Mark, you will find, if you have your Bible now, I'd encourage you to just do this. If you look at Mark 16, you will probably, hopefully, see somewhere around verse 9 and following, brackets or a footnote or something in the margins to tell you that lots of our earliest manuscripts don't have verses 9 through 20. Our earliest copies of Mark end at verse 8, okay? Which is really striking, because what is verse 8? Verse 8 is, it's in the resurrection scene. They see an angel, the women see an angel in the tomb. The angel says, all right, Jesus is risen from the dead. He's gone before you into Galilee. Go tell Peter and all the rest of them. This great sense of excitement. And what do the women do? They run away in fear and say nothing to anyone. Screen goes black. Okay? Most scholars of Mark today think that's the way Mark actually ended the gospel. Okay? Now again, it's probably the case where, and this is my own view on this, that Mark again assumes that his readers are going to know about the appearances of Jesus and what happens afterwards. Obviously, because what? Mark's writing a gospel, right? And believes Jesus is raised from the dead, right? So that's obviously not the end of the story. But for some reason, Mark decides to end with fear and flight from the tomb. That raises questions, doesn't it? Okay? That raises questions. And so what is one of the things Matthew is going to do? Is tell the story of Jesus in ways to attend or kind of resolve or explain some of these questions. Matthew, unlike Mark at the beginning, that block you see there, is going to give us a lot of information about the birth of Jesus. Right? Two chapters. We're going to learn about the genealogy. We're going to learn about Jesus' parents. Joseph doesn't even appear in the Gospel of Mark. Not even named anywhere. Okay? We're going to learn more about that in this story. And we also get more at the end. Okay? Where we get a more robust resurrection scene, where we get Matthew kind of triumphantly ends with the Great Commission story. Jesus appears to the 12 in the Galilee on a mountain and tells them to go forth and baptize the nations. Okay, so that's an interesting... So there's that. Matthew's trying to do that. A couple other issues with Mark. Matthew's trying... Why, in terms of why Matthew decided to write... Has anybody ever seen a red-letter Bible before? Yeah, I grew up, when I was baptized, I had a red-letter Bible my parents had got for me. If you look at Mark in a red-letter Bible, there's very little red. Okay, there's chunks of red, like in chapter 4 and 13 and kind of a few different places, but most of Mark is black ink, which tells you that what? Most of the story is narrative action, doing. Right, Jesus is, he's not really loquacious. All right, he does say some things, but not a ton. So there's very little teaching of Jesus in the Gospel of Mark. All right, which raises the question, what are we supposed to do? Right, how are we supposed to follow this person's way of life if we don't know a ton about what he had to say? Matthew's going to what? If you look at Matthew in a red-letter Bible, there's a lot more red in this Gospel. Actually, one of the things Matthew's going to do right at the beginning of his gospel, chapters 5 through 7, is going to start off the public ministry of Jesus
with probably the most famous sermon ever Jesus gave, right? The Sermon on the Mount. Mark doesn't have any of that material. It's unique to Matthew, and Matthew puts it where? Right at the beginning. Okay? We'll talk more about that next week for sure. Another issue with Mark is, in Mark, the disciples of Jesus are total bimbos. Okay, think about the stories of the disciples, right? Jesus tells them to do things they never understand, right? They're always confused, they're always afraid, Peter's always saying dumb things, right? Now that also teaches what? Mark's using that, the disciples, to teach us something too, right? There's a theological point to be made there about how we're all in confronted with the teaching of Jesus, we don't understand it, and there's a great sense of mystery, that's true. But could it not be that the disciples could also be models for us? Right? Matthew wants to say, yeah, so Matthew gives us more information about the disciples that are a little more positive things to say, as much as he retains a lot of that stuff that Mark has as well. And then finally, there's nothing in Mark about the church. Meaning, in terms of the term for itself, ekklesia in Greek, the term does not appear in the Gospel of Mark. Okay? And it's not really clear what exactly the teaching of Jesus in the formation of the 12, how exactly that relates to the church. It's obviously implied, but it's never what? It's never spelled out. Okay? Matthew is the only gospel that actually does mention church, ekklesia, twice, and has a whole extended discourse of Jesus in chapter 18 on church-related matters. If a brother or sister has a grievance, you've heard this, right? How are they supposed to resolve it? Deal with it among themselves first? You've heard the story, right? And go and ask for help if they can't resolve it on their own, that kind of stuff. It's unique to Matthew's gospel, okay? So Matthew decided to write because there were other stories of Jesus, but they... And Matthew highly appreciated Mark and included almost everything in Mark, but there was more to say about Jesus. Okay, there's more to say, and Matthew thought he could say it in a way that maybe didn't leave so many open-ended questions as Mark did. Now, there's a whole branch of New Testament scholarship that investigates this kind of thing, how Matthew uses the Gospel of Mark, and it's called redaction criticism. Redaction's a fancy word for editing. Editing criticism. Okay, so in my New Testament, one of my New Testament classes at the seminary, I have students work through what's called a synopsis, which is someone has gone through and they've taken Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and they've put the Gospels in parallel columns so you can easily do what? Compare them right across, right? And you can see, assuming that Mark is before Matthew, you can see what Matthew has done to Mark, right? Now, I don't teach this as a kind of deconstructive, critical thing. I see there's an incredible theological resource and power in this kind of... This is in one way of engaging the Gospel of Matthew. Because you see what? Not Matthew's not inventing things just because he doesn't like the way Mark told the story. There's lots of other stories about Jesus Mark did not include, right? Matthew's aware of, so he's including things for a reason. But Matthew's not trying to pull the wool over anyone's face. Right? Matthew's redaction of Mark stems from a trust that there's actually more to Jesus than Mark communicated. Right? So there's an honesty about reading Mark and recognizing some of those problems, but saying, actually, there's more to Christ than this. And I think we can see some of those distinctive things by doing that comparison work. I'm actually going to give you just one example of this. This is going to be hard to read. But I will summarize it for you. This is, I want to mention this one because I'm going to come back to it a little bit later, if not today, then tomorrow, or next Sunday. On the left-hand column, we have Mark 8, 27 to 30, which is the story of Peter's confession. And on the right-hand side, we have Matthew's retelling of this story. Okay, I'm going to start with Mark and just summarize. Jesus is around Caesarea Philippi. He asks his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" The disciples give a couple honest guesses. Then Jesus turns the question on them and says, "Who do you say that I am?" Peter, of course, answers and says, "You are the Christ." What does Jesus then say? Verse 30, he sternly ordered them not to tell anyone about him. Okay? Matthew includes this story. But look at the stuff
in here. Right? Peter gives it, we have Peter's confession here. And Jesus responds to Peter here. Right? Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. There's the first appearance of church in this gospel. And the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. And then he sternly ordered his disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. So Matthew ends with what? Ends with where Mark ended, right? But puts a lot of stuff in the middle there. Think about, given what I said earlier, a lot of stuff about what? The church, right? How Peter's confession, what it means for the church now, right? Now, if this isn't a class on the historical Jesus, so we could, but we could talk about where Matthew got this stuff. It's not my personal opinion here that this is he's inventing this material, but he decided to include it here for a reason, right? This tradition about Peter's confession and Jesus naming him. And that's, I think, for theological reasons, giving some of Matthew's wider concerns of telling the story of Jesus. We'll come back to this in a second. So that's the first, but that whole issue there of Mark and Matthew is the first reason why Matthew needed to write. Because there was another story of Jesus out there. It was a great story, but it also left questions. Okay? Here's the other reason why. It's more of a social or political issue. We don't know any of this for certain, but it's likely the case that Matthew was written in the Roman province of Syria somewhere. Okay? So Jerusalem is down here in Roman province of Judea. This is really, I know this is really, really tiny, but you see there's the Dead Sea right here, the Sea of Galilee. Matthew, some people even think Matthew was written in Antioch. Okay? In Antioch or somewhere around Antioch in Syria. It's not important for us to go into the details of why, even though, again, that's really interesting stuff. But Antioch is a very, even if it's somewhere near the truth, it's important. Because Antioch is a really important city for early Christians. If you've read the book of Acts, Luke says this is the place where Christian people were, the Jesus followers were first called Christians. Okay? It was an urban environment. It was a very diverse place, Jews and Gentiles. And Christianity kind of had its start there after some initial persecution in Jerusalem. So Antioch, the fact that Matthew has been thought to be written in Antioch or around Antioch, okay, that theory crystallizes some really important issues in the later first century, which is we're at a stage in Christian history where we have Christ followers who are Jews and Gentiles, okay, and Gentile pagans, not interested in religion before. And this raises questions, you can imagine, for churches. Right? This is the question of Gentile inclusion. This is the first real theological dilemma for early Christianity. If you read Dan Brown or some of these sensationalizing stories of early Christianity, it's the divinity of Jesus or the virgin birth. Or no, the big issue is what do we do with the Gentiles? That's what Paul's ministry is all about. Right? Paul talks very little about the divinity of Christ. It's high Christology because it doesn't seem like people really disagreed about it. That came later, in the second century. What do we do with the Gentiles? What do we do with the Jewish law? What do we do with the law of Moses? If Gentiles are going to be part of the people of God, do they need to keep the Torah? Do the men need to be circumcised? Do they need to keep kosher? Do they need to keep the Sabbath in the same way that some others do? This was dividing the church, these questions. And you can understand the logic of the positions on either side, right? Can't you imagine Jewish Christians who believe Jesus is the Messiah? Right? What is saying Jesus is the Messiah? How does that negate the Torah necessarily? It doesn't. It's perfectly possible to do what? This is the Messiah. And we continue living according to the way of life that Moses taught us. It's a whole stream of early Christianity where folks thought this way. So these are serious questions by the time Matthew writes. And actually, by the time Matthew writes, we have, maybe you've heard this phrase before, a particular issue, which is known as Gentile hubris. Have you ever heard of this? So this is a case where, if you think about the progression of Christianity in the first two centuries, Christianity began to gain more and more adherence among Gentile circles. Okay? And over time, it became possible for these Gentiles to think what? This story of Jesus has always been about us. Right? We don't really need the Jewish roots. We don't need the fact that... Who cares if Jesus is a Jew? Who cares who Jesus' ancestors were? Who cares about the law of Moses? Right? We are at the center. The church is about us. It's kind of a gross way of putting it, right? But it makes that you see the point. Paul himself is dealing with these questions in his own ministry before Matthew writes, right? I'll give you an example of this. One really famous case from Romans 11. Paul's writing to the church in Rome, which is comprised of Jews and Gentiles. Paul says, "If some of the branches are broken off and you, a wild olive shoot, were grafted in their place to share the richness of the tree, do not boast over the branches. If you do boast, remember that it is not you that support the root, but the root supports you." Why would Paul need to write that? Because there's some Gentiles in Rome who think, what? We don't need the root. There's no need for this. Right? Paul wants to, throughout Romans 9 through 11, describe where the sustenance comes from, where the story of Jesus ultimately resides. And in terms of law observance, Paul is going to take a particularly hard line on Gentiles not needing to keep the law. Right? Paul does not think Gentile men need to be circumcised. That's the whole point of Galatians. Right? Paul doesn't write really at all about what Jewish Christians need to do. His issue is about Gentile churches. Right? But Paul was controversial on this front. Not all Christians thought the same way about this. Paul speaks in a couple different ways on this. I'm going to start here with the Ephesians passage. Paul will sometimes write as though the law, there's really no need for the law anymore. Okay? He says things like this in Ephesians 2, "For Jesus himself is our peace, who made both groups, Jews and Gentiles, into one, and broke down the barrier of the dividing wall by abolishing in his flesh the enmity, which is the law of commandments contained in ordinances." Abolishing in his flesh the enmity, which is the law. You could read that in one way and say, what's Paul saying? Christ, in some sense, replaces the Torah, right? That in himself he might make the two into one new humanity, thus establishing peace, and might reconcile them both in one body to God through the cross, having put to death the enmity, right? So Paul says things like that. But then Paul says in Romans 3, people say, Paul's going around saying we should abolish the law. What does Paul say? Do we abolish the law? Do we make void the law through faith? God forbid, he says. By no means we uphold the law. We establish the law, right? So Paul's in this kind of space where he wants to make a claim about Gentile inclusion, but he doesn't want to thereby say that what? The Torah is not important, right? His ministry... some of his letters are about him trying to explain himself on that front. Okay, so I mention this just so we can see the issues on the table. Because the stuff we were just talking about, those passages, are all from this red area. They're all what? Paul's entire ministry is in between, the in-between time of the life of Jesus and the writing of our first gospel. Right? There are issues under, there are debates going on. Right? There are churches that are fractured and broken. Just as much disagreement among the early Christians as there are now on these issues. So how in light of this, and particularly in light of Gentile hubris in the first century, growing Gentile hubris, how is Matthew going to tell the story of Jesus? I'm going to suggest today that the contours of Matthew's story and its key themes are actually contained in the first 17 verses of the gospel. That portion we normally skip over, the genealogy. This genealogy of Jesus is in Matthew is absolutely fascinating. It's one of my favorite things about this gospel. It's one of these areas where I continue to learn more and be surprised the more I read it and study it. I'm just going to suggest four ways to this morning that the genealogy kind of summarizes or captures something Matthew is trying to do with the story of Jesus and of salvation history. So the first point has to do with the opening two words of Matthew. This is not expecting you to even see this, but this is a cop, an image from P1, papyrus number 1, which is a 3rd century fragmentary copy of the Gospel of Matthew. It's where we get some of our earliest textual evidence for the opening of Matthew's Gospel. So this is the very opening of Matthew, okay? And this is in Greek. I'm going to actually read just the first 2 words in Greek, and I want you to listen and see if you hear anything, okay? I've never done this before, but I want to see if this works. The first 2 words in Matthew's Gospel, the Biblos Geneseos. Biblos, book. Very good. It means book, literally book in Greek. Geneseos. Birth. So genus, you can see the generation possibly. Yeah, that's great. You hear anything else? Generation. Okay, so it's the book of generation, sometimes this is taken to be, it's true. This is actually, literally, this is the title of the book of Genesis in Greek, the Biblos Geneseos, right? So if you look at first century, so Philo of Alexandria, some other places where you have first century Jews talking about the book of Genesis, what do they call it in Greek? The Biblos Geneseos, the book of Genesis. Okay. Now, I've never really actually seen an English translation of Matthew run with that fully, okay? Because even if people could hear other kind of resonances in Geneseos, all that is true. Geneseos can mean genealogy or list or number of other things. But I think it's hard to imagine for first century hearers listening to this in Greek and knowing anything about the Jewish scriptures, would not hear in the opening 2 words what? The title of the first book of the Bible. Okay? Which actually, I think, is something Matthew learned from Mark and just did in a different way. Because what's the beginning of the Gospel of Mark? The beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ. The opening word is arche in Greek. The Gospel of John does a very similar thing. In arche, in the beginning, was the word. Where do you go in your head? It's the first 2 words in the book of Genesis, right? All the evangelists, this is that harmonious dissonance you see, right? The gospel evangelists are doing this in different ways, but they're all kind of telling the story in a way that puts us back at the beginning, right? So now let's just think about this together. What would that mean? Open-ended question. What does it mean for Matthew to open the gospel with the book of Genesis? The book of Genesis of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Does it lead you to expect anything? Any ideas?
One thing might be, yeah, the Big Bang, but it's not that.
Okay. So this is the creation of the world. Okay.
So it's like the dawn thing. In the beginning was the Word. So there's that
connection. Right. So going back to the first part of the story, indeed, yes. Any other ideas? All this is great. This is not like a loaded or a trick question. I mean, I mentioned at the beginning that Matthew was placed first in the canon, not because people thought Matthew was actually written first, but because Matthew made for a nice transition. As Christians are starting to form their own scripture, they have the Old Testament, and then they have a gospel that begins with what? The genealogy of Jesus. Actually mentions the book of Genesis in the opening, right? It makes for it. It shows, in other words, this connection to Genesis shows the continuity, right? The extent of the story, that you can't really understand the story of Jesus unless you also understand the book of Genesis, right? You need to read the story of Jesus in light of that bigger story, right? That might be implied in Mark, but Mark starts right with Isaiah and then goes into the ministry of John the Baptist. Matthew does what by adding in this way? Kind of creates a much richer intertextual field for Matthew to interact with in the rest of the story. I think another way this is significant is, what is the book of Genesis about? That opening is about the creation of the world, right? The good God creates a good world? And then what's the main drama of Genesis? What happens? Does it all stay nice after the first three chapters? No, it's the creation is deformed by human violence and disobedience. And what is the rest of Genesis about? It's about God starting a kind of rescue mission, right? By calling whom? First, Abraham. Right? Through you, Abraham, I will make a great people. And through those people, I will do what? I will bless all the nations of the earth. Right? Starts with the creation of all, goes down to Genesis 12 to the call of a single man from Ur. And through Abraham, Abraham's faithfulness, what's going to happen? God is going to work out the salvation of all creation. Right? I think we're led to expect, by beginning with the book of Genesis, that the story of Jesus, in some way, is part of that narrative, right? In some way brings that story, as Matthew would see it, right, to its climactic fulfillment. So that's the first thing, just the first two words. We're already learning what the story of Jesus means. Here's the second thing. The genealogy tells us about more about the identity of Jesus, which might seem obvious, but it's actually, we learn a lot in particular about the identity of Jesus. I have here on the screen the entire genealogy. I just read, this is from the NRSV, so you see the NRSV translates Biblos Gnesios as an account of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah. I want to look at the rest of that opening line here now. Biblos Gnesios of Jesus Christ, son of David, son of Abraham. To really appreciate what Matthew's doing here, you need to understand that in the ancient world, genealogies were made and understood to function a little bit differently than modern genealogies. Okay, there was this particular kind of function of ancestor lists like this, which scholars describe as giving ascribed honor to people. Okay, so if you look at Suetonius was an early second century Roman historian. He wrote this collection of the Lives of the Caesars. In many of his lives, of each of these famous emperors, he will start with, not this kind of detailed genealogy, but an account of who these people's ancestors were. Okay? And there's an ascribed honor implied, or dishonor, implied in who these ancestors were. So for particular emperors who Suetonius did not like, like Nero, okay, guess who Suetonius highlights in Nero's ancestry? All kinds of people that were egotistical narcissists, right? Because the ancestor is led to make you assume something about the character, the identity, the task of the person that the story is going to be about, okay? Ascribed honor. Same thing is going on here. So what does it mean to call Jesus, first description of Jesus, Jesus Christ, son of David, son of Abraham? Okay, so the first description of Jesus is that he is the Christ, right? Which is in Greek, Christos, is the Greek translation of the Hebrew word Mashiach, or Messiah, anointed one. Okay, so to call Jesus the Christ is to use a messianic title for Christ, for Jesus. It's to place Jesus in a certain messianic office. And then he's specifically named as the son of David and the son of Abraham. Both of these things also, I think, spell out Jesus' messianic status. Son of David for sure, right? We'll talk more about that in a second, but the Messiah was always expected to be one not just connected in terms of ancestry to David, but also to be like David in certain ways. And son of Abraham, Abraham and many of the promises he is given by God, in many of these promises, he has said that it's said that kings will come from him, right? And a great people will come from him. So these were also read in kind of messianic, through messianic lenses in the first century.
Moreover, if we look at the end here, I've also highlighted the very end of the genealogy. So Matthew starts out with this initial kind of brief description, Jesus the Christ, son of David, son of Abraham, then gives the actual list of ancestors. And then Matthew, the narrator, kind of comments at the end. Okay? Sums up and provides this maybe first biblical commentary on the genealogy. Matthew writes, all the generations from Abraham to David were 14, and from David to the deportation to Babylon, or to the exile, 14 generations, and from the deportation to Babylon to the Messiah, or to the Christ, 14 generations. Okay. Notice again at the end here, we have three figures named, also what? Abraham, David, something else in here new, which I'll talk about in a second. And then also Jesus the Christ. Okay, so we get, but now told in reverse order, right? So we go from Jesus backwards, and then down here we go from Abraham forwards, right? But it kind of captures the whole thing, summarizes the whole genealogy in that sense. But this is crucial because Matthew's, how are you going to summarize all of this stuff? Matthew highlights three key figures in the history of Israel: Abraham, David, and Jesus, right? Again, in light of that story and that selective way of telling the story, okay, these people, Jesus is singled out as a person like Abraham or David, a person who structures or periodizes, you might say, the very history of Israel, okay? People who of whom you might say they kind of characterize a certain stage in salvation history, right? Based upon their actions, it affects many others who come after them. You can go a little deeper here still. I was going to mention one thing about the 14, but I'm going to move on because I want to get through this other material here. Abraham and David are not just famous people, okay? They're crucially the recipients of key promises from God. And we're kind of already put back in that Genesis key, invited to make those kind of connections with the initial line of Matthew's gospel. I summarized this already with Abraham. Think about the call of Abraham. The first time we meet Abraham in Genesis 12, it's right on the heels of the Tower of Babel story. Right? And the human arrogance and such that went into that event, and the scattering of peoples in light of that. Right? Abraham comes as the kind of the way in which God is going to redeem all the peoples of the world. Right? God calls Abraham to go from his land and makes issue certain promises to Abraham. One of which, the final one, is, I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Looking back here to the first 11 chapters of Genesis, right? What's going to become of all those people? Well, they're part of the story still. Their blessing is going to come through Abraham in some way. Okay? I'll come back to that in a second. And to David, this is from 2 Samuel 7. David now is king. He wants to build a temple for God. And the prophet Nathan says, no, you're not going to build a temple for God. You're not going to build a house for God. God is going to build a house for you. And Nathan says this, when your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your ancestors, I will raise up your seed, your offspring after you, who shall come forth from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Okay? You can think about some of the issues involved here in this promise. This ancestor is going to be from the line of David, right? Is going to have a kingdom that's established. That ancestor will build a house, will build a temple, you might say. Okay? And the throne of this person's kingdom will be forever. Right? Now you might, if you're just reading in the story, in the Old Testament story, you might assume that who is this referring to? Who comes after David's line? Is a king, establishes a kingdom, builds a temple. Solomon does, right?
Solomon's the next one. But does Solomon's kingdom last forever? It doesn't, right? So in the first century, we know that this oracle from 2 Samuel 7 was read messianically, which means it was read as a prophecy looking for fulfillment. It's something that was not expected of one of the initial descendants of David, but something that was expected to happen from or in light of the Messiah from the line of David. Okay. Now let's think about this for a second. Think again together, right? How do you think that Jesus, the story of Jesus in Matthew, might be told in such a way that we see the outcome or the fulfillment or the fruit of these promises? Do you have any ideas? You have to think creatively, because it's a predict. And then think about the story that comes after. Matthew might be reshaping these in ways you might not initially expect. How about the first one? Prediction to bless all the peoples of the earth. I'll bless all the nations. Ideas? Yeah.
No problem. There's a missing piece here. I mean, this chronology proves that Jesus is the Son of Men.
Yes.
But it doesn't indicate that he is the Messiah. But you're saying there's something we're missing here. How does this show that he's the Messiah?
So Matthew wants to. So the assumption going into the genealogy, I think, is that the Messiah needs to come from the line of David. And so I don't think that anyone would have been able to just read the genealogy and think this person is therefore the Messiah. There would need to also be the evidence of that person's life, right? And particularly the question of how they related maybe to something like 2 Samuel 7. So I wouldn't say the genealogy for Matthew is a demonstration of the Messiahship. But it sets him up, right, to be able to see his ministry in a messianic light. Yeah, right. I mean, because there are other people that were descendants of David, right?
He could have brothers, and they could also have the same genealogy.
Right, for sure. They would all have. You'd assume they would have the same, right? I mean, there is something we haven't talked about this yet. There is something that Matthew will claim is somewhat unique about. So Jesus has this lineage, but he's also born by the inspiration of the Spirit. Right, through the Virgin Mary, which is unlike what you find in the rest of the. But she's not. She's mentioned at the very end. Right, Jacob. So actually, it's this is an interesting issue. But the genealogy goes through the men, right, starting with Abraham, and concludes with Joseph. And then Matthew says, Joseph is the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born. Okay. There's actually a different phrasing here, intentionally. Whereas you get, throughout you get so-and-so begot, so-and-so begot, so-and-so begot, so-and-so. When Matthew gets to Jesus, he uses the passive form of the same verb, was begotten, to suggest that there's something kind of unique about the birth of Jesus. We can talk more about how that relates, but the key thing here is the bringing out of Abraham and David in particular, right? In light of the fact that these people are recipients of key promises for the larger scope of salvation history, right? Here's what I think. So in 2 Samuel 7. We have someone's going to come from the line of David, establish a kingdom. Does that ring a bell? What does Jesus talk about a lot in this gospel, in all the gospels? The kingdom of heaven. Right? There's kingdom language. Now, what kind of kingdom is this? Right? We'll get into that later, the way that Matthew's Jesus describes this kingdom, right? But I think the way Matthew has set it up, you're invited to read Jesus' kingdom of God proclamation as a fulfillment of the promise to David. Right? So the teaching of Jesus now, teaching about the kingdom, takes on kind of a deeper resonance than you might have assumed in Mark. The fact Jesus is going around talking about the inauguration of a kingdom is a kind of messianic action. Right?
Whereas that might be implied in Mark, but it's certainly not clear. Okay. Something else this person is supposed to do. This is really interesting. You find this in all kinds of first century Jewish texts. The expectation that the Messiah is going to build a house for God. The Messiah is the temple builder. Right? Now Matthew, I already said, when is Matthew writing? Matthew's writing 10 years after Mark, which is at least 10 years after Mark, which is 10 years after the destruction of the temple. Right? So how does his Jesus build a new temple? Does Matthew just say, oh, that prophecy doesn't apply to Jesus? Just forget that one. Think about it. Maybe think about your knowledge of the rest of the New Testament. What do Christians do in the first century with some of this temple language? Paul will say on a number of occasions, you all, yins, all, plural, you plural, are the temple of God. Right? There's this idea that the people of God are the temple. Right? So now let's think about this again. When Jesus, think about this way back here to this redaction example of redaction criticism I have from Matthew. The significance of Peter's confession, Jesus responds to Peter and he says, blessed are you, Peter. I tell you, Peter, on this rock I will build. Now think about it. This is where exegesis becomes so fun, because you think there's many different ways, you could use different words, right? I will erect my church. I will establish my church. I will gather my church. Why say I will build my church? Because this is temple building language. This is messianic language. Right? The construction of the ecclesia in Matthew is shaped in this story, in this narrative, as the fulfillment of the promise to David that through the Messiah, God is going to bring about a new temple. Okay? Again, the church. So the church, you could read this story, right? And this all makes sense on one level, right? But when you read it in light of the larger story Matthew's trying to frame it as, it has a deeper kind of significance, doesn't it? There's a deeper echo, you might say. Where you see there's more going on here for the larger scope of salvation history than just some kind of action in Caesarea Philippi in the 30s. Okay, and then for Abraham, quickly. Actually, I'm out of time, so I'll end with this and we'll come back with a few. I'm on point two, so come back with point three and four next time, which is fine. The blessing, or the blessing of the nations, of the Gentiles. Okay, one thing that's unique about Matthew's gospel is that Jesus doesn't really do a whole lot with Gentiles during his ministry. Actually, where there are scenes where Jesus is interacting with Gentiles in Mark, Matthew will often do what to those stories? Cut them out or tweak them a little bit. Okay? Matthew is interested in the Gentile mission, but the Gentile mission for Matthew comes after the crucifixion and resurrection of Christ. And the key moment of transition is on the Mount of Jesus' resurrection appearance in the Great Commission when he says, go therefore and baptize Panta ta ethne, all the nations, which is actually the phrasing of that is drawn from these predictions to Abraham. Okay? So the way Matthew has told the story, it's the message of salvation through the disciples to the Gentiles, right? That is the fulfillment of the promise to Abraham to bless the nations. Okay? It's the mission to the Gentiles is not a plan B. Matthew's gospel has been read this in very anti-Jewish ways in the history of the church, where Jesus goes to Israel and the Jews and they reject it, so God's like, all right, I'm going to start over. I'm going to get rid of those people, or I'm going to start with Gentiles. No. The mission to Gentiles in Matthew only makes sense as the flowering of, the fulfillment of, the promise to Abraham in Genesis 12. It's from the richness of the grace of Jesus, right? For all that the Gentiles get to be included. It's in a very effective attack to Gentile hubris, as I'll talk about more next time. Okay. Thank you very much for your attention. Look forward to being with you next time. Thank you.